Hello, everyone. This is Jerry Pippin, and Jim Mars is on the line from Arlington, Texas, and his dinner's almost ready. So Jim will be a nice host and not keep you too much longer, but we appreciate you hanging here for a little while.
Sure.
And we also have with us Grant Cameron. Grant is one of really the better researchers around, in my opinion. And we're talking basically about RAM, and I thought we would be remiss if we didn't get somebody that was in on that group in the show. And Mark McCandlish is a well-known aerospace guy and interesting fellow. We've had him on a lot. One of the best shows we've ever done with you, Mark, was when you talked about going up to Dulce in the middle of the night, up on top of the Mesa.
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah.
Tell our audience a little bit about your background real quickly.
Well,
why would you be involved in this group even?
Well, I started out in the aerospace industry around 1980 and became interested in some of the more unique types of energy production. I was working at General Dynamics at the time. And began a correspondence with Tom Bearden, who gave me a basic primer on what are called quantum zero-point fluctuations of the vacuum, or zero-point energy. Back then, it was also being called by a number of other names, including scalar energy or cyclotronic energy. I think even as far back as Nikola Tesla's time, they were referring to this particular type of energy as longitudinal waves. So I spent a couple of years working at General Dynamics and then began freelancing throughout the aerospace industry as a conceptual artist and designer. Had a chance to work with all the major aerospace companies and began to see some technology that was obviously way beyond what the public believed we had a capability for producing and deploying. And as time went on, more and more information came into my hands. And then in 1988, a friend of mine let me in on some information indicating that apparently the military had recovered a number of crashed vehicles that had come from some other star system, and that Lockheed had been a major participant in back engineering the technology in the form of what was originally called the Alien Reproduction Vehicle, ARV, or it also had the nickname of the Flux Liner. Flux being
Tell me why it has that nickname.
Well, the Flux Liner, the term flux actually is an electrical term. It comes from the meaning of an electrical potential or an electrical charge. And this particular vehicle does utilize some of those principles. It's primarily a system that's been developed to tap into these quantum zero-point fluctuations of the vacuum. And because of the way the system is structured, it's able to not only use a nearly limitless source of electrical power that's embedded in the fabric of space-time, but it's also able to reduce or completely demass itself so that accelerating up to and beyond the speed of light is actually a reality. And so, this kind of went against the grain for me. It went against everything that I was aware of in terms of what physics claimed was even possible. And so I began trying to find an explanation for why it could be possible. And I also began a correspondence with a number of other luminaries in the theoretical physics realm, including Tom Vallone and Hal Puthoff and a number of their colleagues, and was eventually able to figure out how the system worked. And so that's
okay,
pretty much...
Okay, so before you get out of here, Mark, we're going to talk about exactly how the system worked, but right now we're kind of doing an overview of the whole thing.
Right.
And, Jim, before you go eat dinner, feel free to jump in here with any comments. And, by the way, When did Gordon first come up with the idea with you, Jim Mars, of making a movie? And do you think he ever really talked to Steven Spielberg?
I do not know that he actually got in touch with Steven Spielberg. I know he was wanting to.
He talked about that, too.
Yeah, as I said earlier, I don't think the idea for the film came up until he decided he wasn't making any headway trying to contact relevant people in government and in industry, and particularly the ones who he thought were in charge of the sequestering of UFO information. The only thing I'll add to what Mark just said is that, you know, this in a way ties into my new book, Our Occulted History, Things That Are Hidden From Us, and I deal mostly with anthropology and archaeology, but also in the realm of science. I know in researching for my book, The Rise of the Fourth Reich, we were having problems developing the atomic bomb because using centrifuges to produce enriched uranium, U-235, was proving costly and time-consuming. The Nazis apparently came up with a whole alternative science by using a chemical process to refine uranium and to produce U-235. And so if that's true, there are alternative ways of doing things, you know, that do not fit with what we have been preconditioned by our schooling to accept as scientific dogma.
Yeah, Grant, I find this entire subject fascinating, and Jim just went off on another area that we really haven't discussed too much in this show, and that's the Nazi technology, and it keeps coming up over and over and over in discussions as late as a book on Area 51 a couple of years ago. So that was kind of laughable, but at the same time, they tried to sell that book with a straight face.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I haven't really watched the too much done research on the Nazi stuff. I did have a comment, however, on Mark. Mark's talking about this story back in 1988, and this kind of interested me. I can sort of give you a little bit of the timeline on this, because it's actually pretty interesting. It goes back to our friend at the CIA again. The incident that Mark's talking about occurred on November the 12th, 1988, at Norton Air Force Base. Correct, Mark?
Well, that's where it initiated. I was supposed to meet a friend of mine from college who had contacts with the Department of Defense and with Lockheed Martin. And the gentleman that we were going to be meeting with, and a number of other people, including the late Congressman George E. Brown Jr., who was the head of the Congressional Committee on Space Science and Advanced Technology, along with Alan Cranston, were all at Norton Air Force Base, along with a number of high-ranking congressional representatives and military dignitaries. And they were all put on a military passenger jet, and they were flown up to Air Force Plant 42, in Palmdale, where Lockheed Skunk Works is located, and that is actually where the show took place. That's where they saw all these things.
Okay. That's of interest to me because I don't know if you know, like Aviation Week, just after that, wrote an article, Bill Scott wrote an article, and he talked about these well-choreographed show-and-tell sessions given to selected members of Congress and key government officials, and that they were doing this to garner further financial backing. What interested me was the timing of the November 12th thing, because there's a whole pile of stuff that happened within weeks of that event that seemed to tie in to this idea that maybe they had actually sort of allowed this thing to sort of leak out that they were doing this. And one of the things was, for example, 2 days before that incident with the flux liner, the demo of this thing flying around inside the hangar, was the Defense Department released the fact that they had the F-17 17A stealth fighter. A couple
That's
of
right.
weeks, 4 days before that event was the election. Reagan had left the White House and Bush had been elected. And I remember back, I was involved in UFOs pretty heavy back at the time, and I remember there was always the story that Reagan was involved and Reagan was going to do something. And I remember one of the more dramatic stories was that Reagan, at the end of his presidency, would appear on live TV and he would have the live alien with him. So we were anticipating something was going to happen. And there was a number of things that did happen. For example, this happens on November the 12th. If you go back about 3 or 4 weeks before that, you have what I call the biggest drop of information by the CIA into the UFO community. That was the UFO documentary, this two-hour documentary, UFO Cover-Up Live, where you had the Falcon in the audience, where you had the introduction of the Falcon and the Condor. All that happened about 3 or 4 weeks before that. And the day after that UFO Cover-Up Live, they had a meeting in the Office of the Counterintelligence at CIA, and involved in that meeting was Ronald Pendolfi, Git Green, Richard Weaver, who wrote the Roswell Report for the Clinton administration, and Hennessy, who controlled all the technology, the security for the technology on the black programs for the Air Force. They had a meeting talking about the UFO cover-up live, about Richard Doty playing the Falcon, and if you take that, and then you take after that, within days of this incident where the Fluxliner was flown, you have, probably me in the same time, Robert Lazar phones up Edward Teller, and within days he goes to EG&G and has the first of three interviews to go up to Area 51. That happened exactly the same month as this thing happened. So you take a look at all this stuff, and there's all sorts of sort of dropping things happening around this whole incident at Norton Air Force Base there.
Jim, I'm going to let you go here in a minute, but because I know dinner's ready. But these things happen every once in a while, as Grant talking about. All of a sudden, there's a flood of information, then it kind of goes away.
The one that sticks in my mind, it was in the about June or May of 2001 when Stephen Greer held a big news conference up in Washington. All the major media were there, and he had about 100 plus former military and government people who were all getting up and saying their experiences with the UFOs, and it looked like that might have been about to break a disclosure into the open. But then, despite all the major media being there, nothing really much was said about it except on the internet and the UFO community. And then it rocked along, and then all of a sudden there was a few pieces in the media, and it looked like they were beginning to pick up on it. And then we had 9/11, and that was the end of that. And, that's, you know, every time there's some kind of big, huge, earth-shaking event, if you look closely, it's usually to cover up something else that's going on.
This is true.
It's food for thought, and you just look at the history of all of this.
Yeah.
Not only just with UFOs, but almost any top secret operation that gets exposed.
Yeah.
As some other event comes along. Have you ever noticed?
Yeah, absolutely. Somebody gets shot or something, you know, and it's always something to get our minds off of what's going on.
Okay, let's talk about your book for a minute. It's available now, and you have three possible things besides evolution and creationism. You have another alternative. Is that right, Jim?
Are you talking about within the same book?
Yeah.
Oh, well, actually what I've done in this book, and this is why I think it will really be of interest to you, Jerry, because you cover both topics, is I have combined two topics that were heretofore thought not connected, and that is the one topic, which is hot right now, and a lot of people are onto it, the New World Order, or, you know, the 1%, or, you know, an Illuminati, whatever you want to call them, the idea that a handful of people are trying to run the world largely through economics, okay? That's nothing new. And then there's a growing interest in this topic that's kind of an offshoot of the UFO issue, which is the idea of ancient astronauts or aliens in our distant past. And my hypothesis was, do the two connect? And I was somewhat surprised to find out that, yes, they do. Just to give you a titillating glimpse, we all know the Rothschilds, banking dynasty, is at the top of the pyramid of power in the world today. And I was kind of amazed to find out that some years ago, they even named one of the Rothschilds Nimrod because they claim that they are the descendants of the Sumerian Anunnaki god king Nimrod, who claimed that he was born of an earth woman and a space father. So now the idea is it doesn't matter whether we want to believe all that, okay? The point is they do.
Yeah. Name of that book again?
Our Occulted History.
I like that title, even though it's not about what we call the occult.
Even no, but though it's the
you
astronomical
explained it
sense.
Earlier.
Yeah, it's the astronomical sense. It hides.
And then, of course, this is the 50th anniversary of the Kennedy assassination. Got a new version of Crossfire coming out. I'm sure you got some new information there.
Oh, yeah. It's going to pretty well tell the tale, I think. And that's due out probably in the early fall. I hate to bow out, but I don't want to incur the wrath of the cook.
I understand. I understand. So we're going to let you leave, sneak away from the discussion. Thanks very much, Jim, for taking time out to join us.
Let me just leave you with this. Gordon Novell was just, you know, he was a loose cannon, but he was worse than loose. He was rolling all over the deck. But I think at heart he meant well, and I think he was operating in the only way he knew how to operate as an entrepreneur. And I agree with you. I think his story probably needs to be told, and I would wish that people would take his whole experience, his whole life, into account and not just pick apart a few little tidbits where he may have exaggerated or may have, been proven wrong about something.
Okay, now, Mark, thanks, Jim. Go to enjoy your dinner.
Y'all take care.
Okay, Mark McCandish, I know later on you became disenchanted with Gordon, and we might discuss that in a little bit, but let's get back to how you got involved with him to begin with and this entire group. Did he contact you or you contact him or what?
Well, there was an intermediary. At the time, I was, in November of 1988, I came into this information and I began taking notes on all of the things that my friend had seen, began putting together a scale drawing of everything that he had told me, bit by bit, until I finally finished the drawing in March of 1989. And I sent a copy of this to Brad, who is the young fellow who had told me about this stuff, and I had made several blueprints of it, none of which had any call-outs of any kind. And I sent him a copy, and he called me up on the phone, and he says, Mark, every detail that you've got on this drawing is right on the money. He says, you've scaled it right, relative positioning, the sizes, the relationship between the different components is right on the money. He says, in fact, he says, this probably has to be one of the most dangerous illustrations you've done in your whole career. And he says, if you're smart, you'll tear it up and throw it away, and you'll never talk about it again. Well, of course, I didn't do that, and I I started getting threatening phone calls on the phone.
Who were these threatening phone calls from?
Well, they never said. It was just I'd be out visiting with a client in Los Angeles, where I was living in that area at the time, regarding another illustration job, and my girlfriend would get a call at her home. And the voice would say, a male voice, you better tell your boyfriend to stop doing what he's doing or he's going to be very sorry. Things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Noticed, usually black vehicles with the windows blacked out following me. I would get a lot of interference on the phone line. I would call in to speak to somebody on the radio and the line would be cut off. And the next thing that happened was the Internal Revenue Service started showing up and making allegations about not filing taxes properly, this kind of thing. And it just kind of escalated from there. They came and they seized my cars, seized my bank accounts. I mean, it really got nasty. And so I was getting pretty paranoid by the time that all of this stuff started to really surface. I felt that perhaps the only way I was going to survive was if I went public, and I did it incrementally. I first began calling radio talk shows in the Los Angeles and in the San Francisco Bay Area, superficially describing what I had become aware of, and was met with a lot of skepticism. And then I met a fellow who was a UFO researcher by the name of Paul Shepard. He was friends with the late actor Dennis Weaver and his son Rusty, who lived in Southern California, right across the state line from where Dulce, New Mexico was, and they had reported seeing an awful lot of UFO activity in that area and had communicated this to Paul Shepard. And so I began a correspondence and phone calls and things with Paul Shepard, who was also following the Billy Meyer case very closely at the time. He had a 900 phone number you could call into, and for so many pennies a minute, you could listen to his latest announcement about what was going on with Billy Myers, Semyasi, and the Pleiadians. And so eventually Paul and I met, and I gave him a copy of the blueprint, and he eventually told me in about July of 1989 that he knew someone in the aerospace industry who was very interested in the topic and was interested in commercially developing the technology, wanted to know if I'd like to meet with them. And I said, you know, I'd love to do that, and as long as I don't get shot, you know, in the process. And so he was the one who introduced me to Gordon Novell and his friend, a physicist from Hercules Aerospace in Sandy, Utah, by the name of George Ulick. Gordon and I got along really well, and I eventually introduced him to Brad, and we took him over to Brad's office, which was in the Union Bank building in Pasadena, California, up on the, I think it was the third or the fourth floor. And he told the whole story to Gordon and to George, and it was about that time that Gordon suggested that I should probably label all the components in the blueprint and create call-outs that surrounded the image of the cutaway illustration, explaining what I thought each of the components was supposed to do. And so I did do that, and then I produced a number of copies of that. But at this point, there were, I think, a total of six copies of the blueprint that had no call-outs on it. And so Gordon and George and I had an agreement. Brad did not want to be involved at all because he realized that he was the leak and that he had certain liabilities as a result of that. So he wasn't a part of the agreement at all. And So the three of us, Gordon, George, and I, formed an agreement that if we were able to successfully develop any commercial application of this technology, that we would share equally in the proceeds from that endeavor. But it was basically a non-disclosure agreement as well. And so what I didn't know beyond that point was that Gordon was making copies of the blueprint and handing them out to just about anybody under the sun that he could. And what happened after that was that he wound up giving a copy of this blueprint to Frank Abeta-Marco, who was a production person involved with the Star Trek TV series, knew Gene Roddenberry and those kinds of people, and pretty much explained to him that the technology in the drawing was for real and that all the stuff that the Star Trek TV series was based on was actually a scientific fact. And so what happened from there was that Frank Abeta-Marco sent a copy of this blueprint to his brother, Fred Abeta-Marco, who was the editor-in-chief of Popular Science magazine. And they wound up publishing it in, I believe, February or March of 1994 in their first issue about Area 51. And it was a really small illustration, but as soon as that illustration and the article hit the newsstand, Gordon went through the ceiling and accused me of being responsible for the leak and began calling me and threatening me, and it just kind of got worse from there. So, you know, at the time he was claiming that he was a CIA asset and that he had friends in high places and he couldn't wait to see how they were going to whack me, which was his way of saying shoot me or kill me or some way. So that was when my relationship with Gordon began to go south.
Yeah, I can understand that. Now, you at one time told me off the air in an email, I think, that that Gordon's idea on this vehicle wouldn't work, but you had an idea that did work. Is that right? So in other words,
correct.
I'm asking you if you have an answer to alternative energy here or what we're talking
sure.
about? Or,
absolutely. Yeah.
Can you let our listeners in on a little bit of that?
Well, I can explain first why what he thought this theory of operation was for the system and why it wouldn't work, and then I can tell you what the difference was.
Okay, fine.
Gordon's idea was that you were going to charge up this array of capacitors around the bottom of the vehicle, which was kind of a colossal example of the Biefeld-Brown effect, and that somehow was going to mass cancel the huge Tesla coil that operated within the structure of the vehicle. It was kind of like a Jell-O mold type UFO design. It had a little dome on the top, which was the top half of a ball-shaped crew compartment. And around the belt line of that crew compartment were the huge, in the smallest example, 12-foot diameter primary windings of a very, very large multi-million voltage Tesla coil. Down through the center of that sphere ran the central column, which had the secondary windings of the Tesla coil, and somehow this charging up these capacitor arrays was going to allow for demassing the entire system, which would allow you to send electrons through the windings of the Tesla coil in the same fashion as you might if you were using superconducting materials. Now, he believed that by doing so, you would be able to circulate the electrons around this set of coils at faster-than-light speed velocities. And that was the primary error in his design theory. And I'll get back to that in a second. But the idea was that he was going to take that energy, superluminal electron voltage, and drive a small electric motor. And this electric motor was then in turn going to be coupled to a very large high voltage generator, which would actually wind up producing more electrical power than it took to drive the motor. And all of this, at least by Gordon's theory, was going to be possible because all of the components were demassed by virtue of the Biefeld-Brown effect. So let me go through this and explain why this wouldn't work. Number one, the Biefeld-Brown effect by itself is a polarization process that occurs within the parallel plate capacitors, and there is a kind of levitation that occurs. You can see lifters on the Internet that exhibit this kind of phenomenon. Most people agree that it's a kind of ion emission or an ion wind that actually is able to permit this to happen. Looks like I'm getting a call on my cell phone here. Stand by for just a second. I'll have to talk to you later.
Okay, we're talking about Mark McCandless here, and he's explaining how this works.
I'm back. Anyway, I'm sorry about that. It was an unexpected phone call. The premise that electrons can move through a conductor at superluminal speeds is flawed from the get-go, and the reason is that the thing that separates conductors from non-conducting materials is the fact that the outer electron shell of the atoms of materials like copper, silver, gold, these electron shells have a certain amount of instability in them, and that is to say that they can not only accept but give up additional electrons very easily, and that's the nature of why they're considered to be conducting materials.